Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Later in the show, we'll discuss the brutal heat wave shattering temperature records in Europe. But first, we are pleased to be joined by David Hochschild, chair of the California Energy Commission, the nonpartisan state body dedicated to developing California's clean energy infrastructure. Chair Hochschild was appointed to the California Energy Commission by Governor Gavin Newsom in 2019 and was reappointed to a second term in 2024. He first got involved in the solar energy field back in 2001 in San Francisco as a special assistant to Mayor Willie Brown, where he launched a citywide $100 million initiative to put solar panels on public buildings. He also co-founded the Vote Solar Initiative, a 100,000-member advocacy organization promoting solar policies at the local, state, and federal levels. Chair Hochschild was executive director of a national consortium of leading solar manufacturers and worked for 5 years at Solaria, a solar company in Silicon Valley. From 2007 to 2008, he served as commissioner at the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. For his work to advance clean energy, Chair Hochschild has won many awards, including the Sierra Club's Trailblazer Award and the American Lung Association's Clean Air Hero Award. Chair Hochschild, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. So I'm guessing that a lot of listeners might not be familiar with the commission and what it does. So you chair a five-member commission where four of the five members are required by law to have professional training in specific areas like engineering or physical science, environmental protection. Can you start by telling us more about the commission and what it does?
Yeah, so the California Energy Commission is California's primary energy policy and planning agency. We were founded a little over 50 years ago, really at a time when there was an oil crisis and also an electricity crisis. And there was a plan to build as many as 60 nuclear power plants up and down the coast of California. And so the Energy Commission was born with a mandate really to focus first on energy efficiency and then on energy planning. And then from there, it's really grown to do many, many more things. So we operate the top clean energy research and development program in the nation. We do about $150 million a year for clean tech research and development. We're deploying electric vehicle chargers around the state. Energy storage, solar, wind. We set all the energy codes for new construction. California ranks number one in the United States for energy efficiency in large part because of these codes and for things like televisions and computers. We did the lighting standard, which moved lighting from incandescent light bulbs to high efficiency, high color rendition LEDs and saves, $7 billion a year. So a whole fruit cup of activities like that. We also site new power plants, which are predominantly solar and storage today, as well as things like tribal energy microgrids and a bunch of other programs that we run. So we have about 1,000 people. We're based in Sacramento, but do work across the state.
It's such an impressive list. I first learned about really all of these incredible things happening in California when I interviewed you in April for a Point Blue event. And it was really striking to me because we do this One Planet series on a regular basis. We read a lot about what is happening around climate issues, green energy in California. And a lot of what you just mentioned is not talked about, I think, as much as it should be. Just to add another one here, Oakland electrified all of its school buses. So 100% of children in Oakland now go to school on electric buses. You've got so many interesting facts about how there are more EV charging stations than gas pumps. I think that might surprise some people. What else can you share with us that's about what's happening in California that is not getting the media attention it deserves?
Well, look, I think the big trend is that the electric grid is greening really rapidly. So here in California, we get almost 70% of our electricity on the grid today from clean sources of energy like solar and wind and geothermal and so forth. And that's quite extraordinary. We're the fourth largest economy in the world. And by the way, when we started down this path, really seriously about 15 years ago when Jerry Brown signed the 33% renewable portfolio standard, we were the 10th biggest economy in the world. And as we have greened our grid and added so many electric vehicles and reduced emissions, we've passed Russia and Brazil and Italy and France and the UK and now Japan. And we're now the fourth largest economy in the world. So I think the headline is that it is possible to make your state greener and still have a healthy economy. Obviously, a lot more work to do on making that equitable. But the reason I focus on the grid is that what's happening now is that the reach of this clean electricity is extending to places that people had never imagined, even a few years ago. As you mentioned, Oakland has fully electrified their school bus fleet, 74 buses, 74 chargers. But that's not all. We're electrifying new construction, which was a decade ago about 1% of new buildings in California. We build about 120,000 new homes a year in the state. Only 1% were being built all electric. Most were being built with gas. Today, it's 80% are being all electric, and that number is increasing. So we're seeing this trend of electrification extend to all sorts of places, including here in San Francisco on the Bay. We're building the first fleet of battery electric ferries in North America, five vessels, which will be coming on the water early next year. So a lot of good things are happening, but as you point out, not getting the attention that they deserve.
You talked about equity, and you also addressed this in your talk. How can we address equity in these projects? And it was very interesting to learn that you all launched a program for California's native tribes with a focus on tribal energy sovereignty. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so California has 104 federally recognized tribes, and about 3 years ago, we got together in the North Coast. We had a special meeting. We adopted the first ever tribal energy sovereignty resolution in the United States, which really sets the state's policy to support tribes determining their own energy future and driving towards clean sources. And since then, we've now funded $183 million for tribal energy sovereignty projects, primarily solar battery microgrids. The first one we did was for the Blue Lake Rancheria tribe and up in the North Coast. And these are communities that are typically the first to lose power when you have a storm and there's blowdown of wires, and then the last to get it back on. Some of these communities are losing power 10 to 20 times a year. So these solar battery microgrids help them keep their lights on, operate their first aid clinics, and so on. But we're also doing things like EV charging and now electric heat pumps that are benefiting every one of those tribes. And one of the things we have an opportunity to do is we get money from the legislature to deploy new technologies. Like there's a category called long-duration energy storage, which is energy storage chemistries that last up to 100 hours. So a typical, lithium-ion battery storage unit is only a 4-hour battery, but there's chemistries that go to 100 hours. And so we are deploying those first in low-income disadvantaged communities that have borne the heaviest burdens of pollution and of outages. And so last week, for example, we just approved another $16 million for a long-duration storage project with the Hoopa tribe. And so that's been a really, really exciting part of the work, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful partnership with tribes across the state on this stuff.
What about other frontline communities, disproportionately low-income neighborhoods and communities of color? I'm thinking about those living in Los Angeles or in Bakersfield or any community that lives near oil and gas companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of our policies is that the communities that have borne the heaviest burdens of pollution need to be prioritized. And so in the programs that we operate, for example, I mentioned this Clean Technology Research and Development Program, which is about $150 million a year. We do a whole bunch of demonstration projects of new clean technologies, and about 65% of those projects are going first to low-income and disadvantaged communities. Our EV charging money, we're doing about $100 million a year of that. And also about 60% of those EV chargers are going to low-income and disadvantaged communities. Then we have programs like our heat pump program, which is called the HERA program, which is 100% for low-income households. And I think that is the right thing to do. And also, it benefits everybody because what we're trying to do with these investments is help these industries get to scale. And then as you scale up, the costs come down and it really goes mainstream. And of course, this is what we've seen happen with rooftop solar, where we now have, 2 million solar roofs across the state. So that's a core part of the strategy, not just for the California Energy Commission, but really for all of our sister agencies, the Air Resources Board and the Public Utilities Commission as well.
Can you talk more about where the money comes from for these programs? And also, how do people find out about them?
Yeah, so the research program I mentioned is actually on your electric bill. So you pay, the equivalent of a cup of coffee a year to support all this really important clean energy research, how to make solar panels cheaper and batteries more energy dense and safer and lower cost. And it's why California is the number one destination state for clean tech investment. We leverage many times over the amount of money that goes in. We attract and follow on capital to help scale these clean solutions. We get a lot of money from other things, like in the state budget. And then, if you recall, about a year and a half ago, there was a climate bond that the voters passed, $10 billion. So, for example, we got about $500 million there for port upgrades, which we're using to do port upgrades in preparation for offshore wind. So it's a variety of different sources.
Today, we are speaking with David Hochschild, chair of the California Energy Commission, the nonpartisan state body dedicated to developing California's clean energy infrastructure. If you have any questions for Chair Hochschild about what is happening in California around clean energy, how frontline communities are really one of the focus, really, when you're talking about equity. If you live in a frontline community, we'd love to hear from you. And then later in the show, we will talk about how the state is responding to the Trump administration, which is moving in the complete opposite direction. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Obviously, we're going to talk about the Trump administration, but I want to talk about a few other programs that are happening in California. I was just reading from Fuel Cell Works that there is a $135 million state investment matched dollar for dollar by automakers, delivering more than $270 million in a point of sale savings for California's first-time EV buyers. Of course, we had this program in place for a couple of years, and the Republican Party got rid of it. So this is another new EV program. What can you share about it with our listeners?
Yeah, so this is a really important rebate program operated by the Air Resources Board. And it's super important because, look, right now, what is happening is the Iran war has spiked gasoline prices, not just here in California, but across the country and around the world, and raising everybody's costs. So the New York Times just did a review of what it costs to drive electric, and it's basically a third of the cost per mile. So you can save a lot of money. However, they're more costly upfront, in part because the federal tax credit is gone and they're not yet at large volumes in California. So the key hurdle is this upfront cost. And that is what this is intended to do, is to replace the tax credit that President Trump eliminated. And I'll just say, EVs are growing really rapidly around the world. The largest auto market on the planet is in China, and they're today at 61% electric vehicles for new vehicle sales. And so that is the future. I think how quickly we get to that future matters a lot. It will reduce emissions, it will save costs, and we can make that transition happen. The big focus for us, as you referenced earlier, is just getting the EV charging infrastructure in. We now have 216,000 electric vehicle charge plugs, public and shared charge plugs in California, versus only 120,000 gasoline nozzles in the state, and we're adding a lot more and a lot more fast charging coming. But the other big barrier is the upfront cost. So that's what this rebate program will help.
What's happening in China around electric cars is really incredible. You could get a micro car starting at around $4,500. And then, of course, there's the high end, but we're talking $4,500 to $8,000 for an electric car in China. They go faster, a further distance than the cars in the United States. Do you think that electric cars from China will ever be sold in the U.S.?
It's a great question. And you're absolutely right, first of all, on the quality of the vehicles. And I'll be going there in November. We're going to be visiting a Chinese auto dealership. But there are like 300-mile range EVs, really high-end cars for $18,000. And at the more affordable end, as you suggest, you know, between $4,000 and $8,000. And so that's part of why it's growing. They've just made it really affordable. There is functionally a wall around the U.S. market right now. You know, the way that Chinese auto companies are entering, you know, is through setting up a U.S. subsidiary, which is what BYD did for buses, for example. They have an electric bus factory in Southern California, but it's really limited. So, you know, Mark Carney in Canada just did a deal to get almost 50,000 Chinese EVs into the Canada market. It's hard to imagine that happening under President Trump, but who knows? I do think if those were available, they would be selling like hotcakes. But my hope is that the U.S. automakers, you know, can really, you know, resist this pressure to shut down their EV operations, because particularly now with gas prices so high, it's not strategic, and we risk a future in which we become kind of an island in the world of, you know, internal combustion engine vehicles as the rest of the world goes electric, and we really, you know, miss the chance to be successful economically beyond our borders with our major car companies. So this is one of the main focuses we have to have, is keeping the U.S. automakers in the electric vehicle game.
Well, electric cars are finally coming down in price in the United States. I was just looking online. I'm looking at a 2016 Ford Focus, fully electric. It's got only 34,000 miles, and it's about $12,000. And really, when you think about the gas savings, especially now, if you have a slow charger, it doesn't cost that much at all. You could go from 50 miles to about 220 miles for about $8. And when you think about how much it would cost with gas, it's so much more expensive. So electric cars are finally coming down in price. And do you know if this rebate system applies to used electric cars, or is it just new cars?
You know, I don't. The tax credit had applied to both used and new, and I'm not sure if they've developed those rules yet. But you can find out more about how to get electric car at electricforall.org is the website to go to. It shows you all the models and all the chargers that are available for sale in California. And you're absolutely right. You know, you mentioned used cars, and I just want to highlight one thing that's really important, I think, for the public to understand is EVs don't age the same as conventional internal combustion engine vehicles. You have 250 moving parts in a typical ICE vehicle engine and only 7 in electric fuel. So I've been driving a Chevy Bolt electric car for 8.5 years. Mm-hmm. I've had absolutely no issues with it. There's no air filters, oil changes, spark plugs, transmission, you know, you don't worry about catalytic converter theft. It just works. The only thing I've had to do is replace the tires, which I did about 6 months ago. And so it is, I think, a really wonderful feature for electric cars, but it's also part of why there's been resistance from some of the car companies, because a lot of the car companies make their money on the servicing of the vehicles. You know, it's kind of like buying a really cheap printer and then the ink cartridges are really expensive, right? That's kind of how it is with cars. And so that's why, you know, something that's so good for consumers has been kind of resisted, unfortunately, by some in the auto industry.
Right. You're right. Such a good point about the oil change, because that's also going up in price. On today's Your Calls One Planet series, we are speaking with David Hochschild, chair of the California Energy Commission. This is the nonpartisan state body dedicated to developing California's clean energy infrastructure. If you have a question for Chair Hochschild, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, Rose. Hi, David. I'm in a financial category where it don't qualify for low income. Definitely don't want to put out $30,000 for a rooftop solar. I purchased a electric car. PG&E gives us reasonable or near commercial rates up until 3 p.m. to charge the car. But after that, it goes up to peak. And if you're using electric to heat your house in winter between 3 and, say, 7 o'clock, you're paying 60, 65 cents, I believe, roughly, to use that electricity. And I'm wondering about plug-in solar. It seems affordable. It doesn't seem like it's being addressed in a uniform manner between counties and counties. And its effectiveness, it looks reliable. They're using LG batteries as battery packs, and they're two panels. They supply 1,600 watts of power, which can kind of offset that that hit during 3 o'clock and 7 in the winter when you want to use an electric heater to heat your house. What do you think about that? And just as a sideline, I wanted to mention that Sunrun is run by Elon Musk, and do avoid their company if you can. They will get you hooked up in a long-term lease, and you may not even be able to sell your house once it's installed unless you pass it on to the new buyer.
Wow. Well, thank you for the call, David.
What the caller is referring to there, plug-in solar is something that was pioneered in Germany, and it basically is a very simple, scaled-down version of a more conventional rooftop system with an inverter and so forth. It's basically where they have a microinverter on the back of the panel, and you can just plug it into your wall, into an outlet that feeds power back. That is still something of a gray area in the policy world. And I think there's a piece of legislation moving through the legislature this summer to kind of clarify the rules about that. One of the concerns from the utility safety aspect is that if power were to be fed back on the grid and they think it's off, the lineman can get shocked. So I think that's one of the safety issues they're working through. But it's a very low-cost solution, as the caller suggests. And I'll highlight, what the caller was referring to about high electric rates is absolutely right. And what is driving that? Actually, it's really important to recognize the number one driver of high electric rates, which were basically very stable from 2000 to 2017 and 2018, is climate-driven wildfire. And this huge cost to do vegetation management and utility undergrounding and all of the costs associated with these colossal fires. And so you have a situation in which climate change is making it harder to fight climate change. We have to keep electricity affordable because we want people to use EVs and use electric heat pumps. And there's this like huge climate cost, which is, I think, very unfairly raising people's electric rates. And that's really one of the main things that the next governor, I think, is going to have to lean into. And there are remedies. And I'll just say, one of the solutions to that is more electrification, actually, because the electric, the money that people pay for electricity for electric vehicles and so on can actually help drive down electric rates over time. But plug-in solar is one of the remedies people are looking at now to help mitigate that.
Thank you so much for the call, David. Let's go next to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding.
Hey, well, I'm just a little concerned that California isn't making solar affordable. For one, the CPUC changed the amount of the value of the energy you export. It was cut by 75% compared to older NEM plans. But secondly, as the caller just mentioned, I leased solar from Sunrun. I paid a lot of money to get all my appliances switched to electric and got leased from Sunrun, and my bill is higher than it was under PG&E, and now I'm stuck on a 25-year contract. Wow. So I think that I'm wondering what kind of regulation of the solar companies is occurring and whether the CPUC is really helping people to be able to afford moving towards solar.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear if that was your experience. So that is a question more for the Public Utilities Commission than the Energy Commission. We don't set the net metering rules. One thing that is in our control, we're really looking to do is reduce the soft costs. If you look at Australia, for example, which has the lowest cost rooftop solar in the world, it's about one-third of the cost to install rooftop solar in Australia, and about half the homes in Australia have rooftop solar. They've made the soft costs, which by that I mean, like, I'm not talking about the hardware, I'm talking about all of the other, permitting and the installation, way cheaper. So basically the way it works in Australia, you just, as a customer, you order solar, it comes out, they install it, and then they inform the utility that it's been completed. It has to be a certified installer, but there's a whole series of inspections and permits and so on that we require that take both a lot of time and a lot of money to complete that make that cost higher in California. So we've just rolled out something called CalApp, which is a software that basically allows instant over the internet permitting. And that's helping a bit. Permitting used to take up to 60 days in many jurisdictions in California and cost quite a bit. So this is making it, so we pushed out $20 million in grants to counties around the state to adopt that. So helping to reduce the soft costs has been our focus to the problem, which is only part of the solution, but it's an important part because we can do a lot better. And by the way, I mentioned Australia, they've just launched this month something quite extraordinary, which is free electricity for the whole country from 12 to 3 p.m. First time they're doing that. They have such a surplus of solar in the middle of the day. And of course, if you have access to that, that's when you can charge your electric vehicles or charge up your heat pumps and so on. So I think quite a visionary step there that I'd love to see us look at here in California.
Chair Hochschild, I just looked up Sunrun and high bills. A number of people are asking, why are my bills higher with Sunrun than before they were installed? Do you have any tips for Lisa and anyone else who's dealing with this?
I spent my career in solar before this. I always, always recommend getting three bids before you do, at least three, before you do any purchase, and compare and contrast, and you'll find sometimes a pretty big difference. So the company that advertises the most may not be always the lowest cost. You want full transparency on what the rates are. Nobody should have a situation like the last caller where their rates are going up. That's not a good deal. Definitely get multiple bids before you they will typically, when you do a lease, it used to be 20 years, since like the last caller got a 25-year lease, but there's a small escalator, built into that. So you got to make sure you know what that would have been had you stayed on your electric rate, so you're not getting over time, paying really exorbitant rates, for decades. And so the best way to do that is compare and contrast, get a lot of bids before you make a purchase.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Lisa, and I'm sorry to hear about what has happened. We'll do another show about this. Chair Hochschild, I want to also make sure we have some time to talk about wind energy, because there's so much coming out of the Trump administration, canceling wind farms. They are paying off wind farms to stop what they are doing. And then some news just came out about the state of California possibly suing the administration over this. So can you give us an update? What exactly is happening with offshore wind in California?
Yeah, and with wind generally, I mean, look, I think the Trump administration is engaged in a war on innovation. And I think it's absolutely to the detriment of our country and our state in our world. Generally, the nations that thrive tend to be the ones that lean into the technologies of the future. And this effort to kind of turn back the clock by doing these absurd actions. If you recall the offshore wind projects on the East Coast, you know, they issued stop work orders for all of these projects, that some of which were 95% complete. Okay. Offshore wind is a domestic resource. It's clean. It works really well. It's been a big part of what Europe is doing, China's doing. And to stop these projects. Now they all contested that in court and they won. Here in California, we're in a different circumstance in which we have these five lease areas on the central coast and the north coast, about 583 square miles. They're all 20 miles off the shore of California. We're not in construction, but they are doing these lease buybacks, which we believe are illegal. So we've been working with our terrific Attorney General, Rob Bonta, and announced... gave the notice of litigation this last week to contest these illegal lease buybacks. So what they're trying to do is buy the lease back from the wind company and then force them to put the money into fossil fuel development, typically in the Gulf Coast. So we're contesting that. And I would also point out the Trump administration is fighting and basically stopping every terrestrial wind project in the U.S. And again, this is absurd. This is... domestic, accessible, reliable, efficient electricity. And at the same time, they're contending that somehow we're in an energy crisis. And so these things don't add up at all. The other argument, I should say, that they made for trying to cancel all offshore wind around the world, around the nation, is that it's a threat to national security. And I think that is patently untrue and absurd. Every one of those offshore wind lease areas, including the ones in California, was signed off on by the Department of Defense before the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued the lease areas. But look, the real cost to us is that we are falling behind. And so you look at what China's doing. They are the largest builder and the largest market for terrestrial wind and for offshore wind. They're now ahead of us on technology. And just to give you a sense of scale, the wind turbines they're building now offshore in China are the largest in the world. So one rotation of one of these turbines can power two houses for a day. And if you think about that resource, offshore wind typically it is a much better resource than wind on land. And most of your electric demand around California and around the world is actually on coast. That's where the big cities are. Think about our population centers here in California, Oakland and San Jose and San Francisco and San Diego and Los Angeles. I mean, very close to the coast. And so having that clean resource is super strategic as we electrify everything. And also the generation profile of offshore wind really beautifully matches solar. You see in the late afternoons and early evenings, the solar production go down. That's when wind production offshore is ramping up. So it's a really strategic investment, both for our state and our nation. We're going to vigorously contest the Trump administration's efforts to undermine our offshore wind program.
And we have so many more questions, so we're going to have you back. Ruby wants to know, where is the additional electricity coming from? Can solar and wind really give us enough?
Yeah, this is one of the most exciting things, and I think a hidden attribute that does not get the attention it deserves. The beautiful thing about clean energy sources like solar and wind and batteries is you can build them fast. So it's not just that they're clean, it's not just that they're cheap, they're also fast. So we have about 106 gigawatts total of capacity, electric capacity, in the state of California. So a gigawatt for context is about the peak demand of a city like San Francisco. And we're building about 7 gigawatts a year now. And so 32 gigawatts just since Gavin Newsom became governor of California in 2019. So that represents 30% of the entire grid capacity that we've added in the last 7.5 years. And that is almost entirely renewable energy and mostly solar and batteries. And we're building now the largest battery project in the world, the Darden Clean Energy Project in West Fresno County. It's a $5.5 billion project. We have another project that's twice that size that's coming to us for permitting in the fall. And so there's a lot of momentum. And you know, if you think about trying to build like a new combined cycle natural gas plant, that takes 7 years, okay? Nuclear, which actually, you know, there's only been two nuclear plants built this century. The last one was, you know, in Vogtle 2 and 3 in Georgia, and that took 17 years. And so this is one of the great attributes, is the sort of simplicity of these clean energy systems, which allows them to be deployed really quickly.
Gosh, there's just so much happening that deserves so much more media attention. And imagine if you had federal support for all of this. I'm hoping that that will happen one day. David Hochschild is chair of the California Energy Commission, the nonpartisan state body dedicated to developing California's clean energy infrastructure. Chair Hochschild, thank you so much for joining. And we have so many questions that we didn't have time for. So we hope you will join us again.
My pleasure. Be delighted. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm so sorry we didn't get to all your calls and your emails, but we will invite Chair Hochschild to join us for a future show. Coming up after a break, we will discuss the heat wave that we are seeing in Europe. The UN says that Europe's heat wave has the fingerprints of the climate crisis all over it. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.